UK Wine Show, show number 178. International Wine and Spirit Competition with Alan Gibbons. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and it's show number 178 for the 16th of October 2009. On this week's show, we're going to be talking with Alan Gibbons. Alan is the Executive Director of the IWSC, or the International Wine and Spirit Competition for the rest of you guys, and he's responsible for the strategic development of the competition. We're going to be talking to him about how the show's developed in the past, its judging process, and the loss of a major supporter in terms of the Harper's magazine that was affiliated with them until last year. Well, for personally, this week's been a bit of a difficult week with some tough decisions and some risky decisions on some software that we're having developed. Not a good time to take a risk, but hey, gotta do it sometimes. I'm going to give you more information about the software probably after Christmas, but it's quite exciting stuff. And I'm just finishing off a new website with a rather large knowledge base, pulling together all the articles and news that we've put together for the wine show. So hopefully it'll all be good. But apart from all that software and website stuff, I've had some excellent fun and been doing quite a bit of wine tasting in the last week or so. I ran a couple of huge corporate events, as well as a really small girls survival weekend, which was quite good fun. It's also seen me getting my prep done for the wine show, which is starting next week. It's in Islington. The wine show starts on Thursday, the 22nd of October, and finishes on the 25th of October in London's Islington Design Centre. If you can make it to London for the show, do come and see me. It's certainly one of the best shows open to the public in the UK. And come and say hi. I was hoping to give some tickets away, but all the subscribers to our newsletter managed to snaffle them up first before I could get them out to you guys. So if you get our newsletter, you've probably got some tickets to the show. If not, I'm sorry. Perhaps you want to subscribe to the newsletter. It's going out again in about 2 weeks' time. One other last thing. I have set myself up a Twitter account. I know, dreaded Twitter and all that sort of stuff. My name is Wine Scriber. So that's Wine Scriber, as it sounds. So if you want to follow me, that'd be fantastic. So let's crack on with this week's show. In the spotlight this week, we have our book review. Now, we don't normally do book reviews so soon after the last one, but I want to review three books before Christmas so that I can include them in my Christmas recommended readings, if they make the grade, that is. So this week, we are reviewing less of a wine book and more a wine phenomena. We reported a wee while ago that Gary Vaynerchuk had a $1 million deal. Well, his first book came out on Wednesday, Crush It, Why Now is the Time to Cash in on Your Passion. So we review his book in this week's Spotlight. And this week we have a mystery region. If you're new to the show, that means I'm going to give you two sets of clues and you have to work out what wine region I'm talking about. Our mystery region is located near the coastal town of Alicante in Spain. It is hot, high and dry, with vineyards planted in light sandy soils that lie over limestone. Production is aimed at red wines, with the main grape being Monstral, but some Tempranillo and Grenache and Cabernet Sauvignon also there. Arion and Macabeo are the main white grapes, and there's a bit of Pedro Ximenes for making sweet wines. Have we think about that? I'll give you more clues after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. A Tesco shopper has fallen foul of new guidelines which support the government's Think 25 responsible drinking campaign. The 28-year-old woman was stopped from buying wine as part of her weekly shop because she was accompanied by her 17-year-old sister, a minor. She was told she wasn't allowed to buy the wine in the presence of someone who's unable to produce ID. Tesco has put in place new guidelines introduced to limit access to alcohol amongst youngsters. The store operates a strict Think 25 policy, which means if someone looks under 25 and doesn't have appropriate ID or can prove they're over 18, they will not be sold the alcohol. Additionally, if staff suspect proxy selling, that is, alcohol being purchased by an adult for someone underage, the sale will also be refused. The duty manager at Tesco did in the end sell her the alcohol and apologised for the mistake.
Well, it sounds that some small checkout purses are having some fun at the expense of Tesco and their customers. Either that or they're still possibly a school hall monitor. Apparently, Connie was the fifth person that he had stopped that day. Either way, this is just some bad press for Tesco. But it's not the first time this has happened either. In March, a 56-year-old mother was refused to buy wine. It does show that where laws are implemented, especially where there's a judgment by someone to be made, people will interpret the rules differently. The fact that there's a problem highlights two things. First of all, it highlights that the Think 25 program of proving your age is working and Tesco is implementing it. I say good on them for that. But please improve your system so customers are managed better once they've been refused a sale. What's next, Jane?
Well, a wine company has taken part in a test to demonstrate for the first time how wastewater can be converted into fuel. The Napa Wine Company offered up their winery for the test, which converted their wastewater into hydrogen gas using a hydrogen generator and a small amount of electricity. The wastewater in the winery comes from cleaning equipment, grape disposal, winemaking and other processes. The company already treats wastewater and recycles it, and the water from this microbial electrolysis test will join other water for further treatment and then be used in irrigation. It's hoped the hydrogen could eventually be used to run vehicles and power systems.
Great stuff! I like it. But that's my engineering side coming through. I'm not so sure how much hydrogen is going to be made, or even if it's going to be net energy positive. But experimentation and exposure will help us lead to the new hydrogen economy. What's next, Jane?
Well, finally, wine writer Michael Broadbent has won a libel case against Random House over allegations in the book The Billionaire's Vinegar. The book suggested he behaved inappropriately when he auctioned bottles of wine from President Thomas Jefferson's collection while at Christie's. Broadbent authenticated the 1787 Lafitte that bore the initials THJ, etched on the side, and sold for the record sum of £105,000 24 years ago. The book suggested he had behaved in an unprofessional manner and that his relationship and dealings with Hardy Rodenstock, who discovered the original collection, was suspected of being improper. Random House must now remove copies from bookshops in the UK. But the English courts only cover publications in England, so if Random House continued to publish in the US, they can't guarantee copies won't turn up in the UK, and therefore any reissue in the States would repeat the libel. Random House apologised unreservedly for making the allegations and accepted they were untrue. It's given an undertaking not to repeat them and paid Michael Broadbent undisclosed damages out of court. But that's not it. Broadbent must now decide whether to take out an injunction against the book being made into a film. The rights have been optioned and a film to be produced by Hollywood star Will Smith is said to be in development. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website 3050.co.uk for all these news stories.
Cheers, Jane. I said it when the case was first announced, and I'll say it again. Forcing a company into retracting something by threatening them with a UK libel case is never going to find the truth of the matter. It's a foregone conclusion the publisher was always going to fold. However, I have managed to order a copy from Amazon, and there's a US bookseller more than happy to supply me with a copy of it for about £13. So I'm going to review the book after Christmas. I'm going to have to review it after Christmas because there's so many books I want to review before Christmas. So let's start with this week's book review in the spotlight, Crush It by Gary Vaynerchuk. Now, this is not a wine book. It's a book from a wine phenomena. Crush It is Gary Vaynerchuk's move to leverage his social media status built up through his wine business, Wine Library, into business guru status. In Crush It, Gary gives a brief overview of his life stories, his outward ways, and shows how he crushed it, first in baseball cards, then in wine. And he gives us plenty of tips for becoming a web personality, including a 21-point plan. But the final page pretty much sums up the book. Listen to your DNA. Success, financial, personal, and professional, lies above all in loving your family, working hard, and living your passion. Not a new message, but one that's been given quite well. Gary is not just a wine guy. He sees himself as a businessman giving sagely advice from the twittering trenches. Crush It is a punch of energy to any entrepreneur, and the message is delivered with energy and passion. And it is Gary's passion as a businessman that surprised me the most. Wine is a passion and a business, which is the way it is. But it's one of the many passions such as baseball cards, wine, business, and social media. Crush It is true to Gary's DNA. It's open, honest, and an inspiring read. The book itself is quite short, and most of you could read it in a long afternoon, even though I found myself having to speed read it, just to keep up with Gary's narration. It has pace and kept me engaged and enjoying the read, particularly given it's more of a business book. Crush It is part self-help for those who want to be rich and famous and part insight into Gary's life. It speaks volumes about where Gary feels he is. And has he crushed it yet? The answer is definitely yes. Well, in the US at least. Will he crush other businesses? Yes. Does he want to crush you? No. There's a lot of crushing going on, but no one's getting hurt. I thought it was a really interesting book from a web and wine expert on how he did it. I liked it, and I gave it 89 out of 100. So, be warned, it's a great personal business book, but a pretty poor wine book. It's not what I was expecting when I ordered it, but I'm pleased I read it. Next week, we have another book review. We're going to be looking at Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion, 6th edition. I've spoken to the publisher about it, and they've given me a copy to give away on the wine show, which is fantastic. So I'm going to be giving away a Concise Atlas, Michael Schuster's Wine Essential book, as well as the Hugh Johnson Wine Companion book. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to run a competition each time the book review comes out, and you've got a chance to win it. Fantastic. I do have a winner for last week's book competition, where we were giving away a copy of the English and Welsh Wine Guide, which is going to Nick in Slough. So that book will be on its way to you, Nick, soon. If you do want to enter, give it a go. You've got a good chance of winning a book. We didn't have too many entries. We had a few, but not too many for the last book. Okay, next up, we've got our second clue in our mystery wine region. As you recall, it's a wine region in Spain, and the whole area is made up of the provinces of Murcia and Valencia, and goes under the name Levant, so called because it's where the sun gets up in Mediterranean Spain. And it's the dry Levantian breezes off the Mediterranean that influence the climate, making it semi-arid. However, early harvest and modern winemaking methods enable DO wines to be made of good quality. Okay, that's the last clue in our mystery wine region. Have a wee think about that. I'm going to give you the answer after our interview, which is with Alan Gibbons. Remember, as I said, Alan is from the International Wine Spirit Competition. We talked to him about the International Wine Spirit Competition. Let's have a listen to what Alan has to say. Hi, I'm here with Alan Gibbons. How are you, Alan?
I'm good, thank you.
You're the Executive Director of the International Wine Spirit Competition.
I am indeed. I have been for the last 3 years.
So, International Wine Spirit Competition, there's three big competitions in the UK. Your one, International Wine Spirit Competition, yep. International Wine Challenge, and yep. Decanter. I would say they're the main ones.
They are, and I mean, we're very lucky in that they're probably the three premier ones in the world as well, never mind the UK.
Yeah, so there's a lot of regional competitions, but we won't talk about those ones. Okay, let's just talk a wee bit about the International Wine Spirit Competition. You guys have got a very strange way of releasing your results. You know, we're currently recording this at the London International Wine Fair, and Decanter released their results. Yep. International Wine Challenge released their results. You guys have just released half your results.
That's right.
What are you trying to do? Tease people or something, mate?
No, we took a decision about 3 years ago now that from talking to wine producers, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, they were saying, look, we understand wine competitions. We like entering wine competitions. The biggest problem we have is because, in essence, what a wine competition historically has done is draw a line in the sand, say, get your entries in by then, judges them, publishes the results. That's too early for the Southern Hemisphere. And what happens is you're judging last year's wines in many ways. So the commercial value is negligible because they've already sold that product.
Yep.
So what we did was we changed our deadlines. Because the big difference between us and most other competitions is we actually exist all year round as a business. So we can do that. We don't come together for a month or something like that. So we just moved our tastings for the Southern Hemisphere to September, October, mainly September. And that meant that in the first year, we got a whole bunch of whites in from New Zealand, for example. It also means that we're actually the first international competition that judges that year's Sauvignons from New Zealand, so it's a really good advantage for us, and certainly it means that the wineries themselves can make hay when they win at our competition.
Oh, okay, it's quite good actually, though it's particularly because you get, like if you use, say, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc as an example, it does age, or can age quite quickly, not so bad under screw cap these days, but it does age, and availability can become a problem towards the end of the year, really, for them.
So it does. I mean, it's up to the winery. They can obviously hold things back if they wish to and enter them the following year, but it does get us those first really fresh Sauvignon Blancs, particularly, it has to be said. And it's been a real boon for us, and we've certainly not had any bad feedback. It's all been positive about that change.
Excellent, excellent. So how do you do your judging? Do you do it in two flights twice a year? How does the process of
from asking for entries through to the judging and then the delivery of the results? How would that process work usually?
We do realistically three tranches of judging, and we'll probably start judging around about March time, and we will finish our Northern Hemisphere judging about 2 weeks before this fair, which means there's an awful lot of work in the last 2 weeks getting all those results together.
Yep.
We'll start doing our spirits judging in about a fortnight's time, but our Southern Hemisphere won't start until July time, and then that will run through until the back end of the year, September time, for New Zealand and Australia specifically. The judging itself is done... the phrase we've used in the past is double blind. And what that means is we don't use bagged bottles. All wines are decanted in a separate room so that all the judge will ever see at the IWSC is a numbered glass.
That's quite interesting because I've done judging at other competitions in the past, International Wine Challenge, and we were doing a flight of Italians.
Yeah.
And we knew which ones are IGT and which ones were DO, because IGT allowed screw cap, DOCG and DOC aren't. So we sort of immediately had an idea of the quality position of the wines just by looking at the top of the bottle, really.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I mean, certainly if you look at the spirits business, for example, where there's probably more variety in terms of bottle shape and things in many ways, specific to brand, if you think about the Johnny Walker square bottle, you know, if you're from the spirits business, you know what that product is from 2 inches sticking out the bottom of a top of a bag. That's not a problem.
Yeah.
And we wanted to take that out. So as I say, everything is poured in a separate room and it's just a numbered glass. So the best thing that we ever have is when we announce the results and some of the judges are kind of, oh, wow, I didn't realize I actually voted for that. I mean, there was one year they were convinced they were drinking one wine and it turned out to be an entirely separate product. And had they known that, human nature suggests it would have potentially influenced their decision, but it didn't.
Some of the competitions, they tell you about the flight, it might be a load of Italian Anez grape or something like that.
Oh, yeah. What we do is they know that their taste, they know the country, they know the region. The way we do the tasting is we do it by vintage, variety, and region. So in many ways, we start off with lots of individual regional competitions in a funny sort of way and then build that up so that they do know what they're looking for. In the way we like to say it is what we're looking for is the best expression of a particular region and vintage, etc. So it's important that they do have that information.
What about if some wines the public don't like? I've just been in a meeting talking about different wine critics and versus what the public like. And some wine critics get quite far up their own bums in terms of what they like because they're exposed to so many wines that they land up liking quite niche things that most people don't like. Do you find that's an issue with your judges? Do you find that some wines, whilst technically brilliant and a lot of the people in the trade might go, wow, this is a really interesting wine, the public may not necessarily like that?
Well, I think potentially, but we try and get rid of that issue. And the reason we get rid of that issue is because of we're obviously putting things through flights, through panels. I mean, obviously, if it's an individual writer's view, then it is a very subjective view. They may be hugely experienced, but it's still a subjective view. We do try and leaven that a little bit in terms of having panels of seven people, for example.
Who are your judges? How do you select your judges?
We've got about 300 judges, I would think, on our books. Some of them are very specialized, some of them are generalized. They're everything from winemakers, distillers, blenders, buyers. It's across the trade, writers. It is literally across the trade.
Okay. And do, I suppose, the wine people judge the wines and the spirits people judge the spirits? Do you get any crossover?
There are some people, but very few, to be fair. We have an independent technical and judging committee, which is headed up by David Wrigley, who's Master of Wine and works for the WSET as his day job. And David makes sure that every single judge goes through an induction program. it doesn't matter who you are. If you want to judge for us, you have to go through an induction program.
Okay, what does it entail?
It's just about understanding, calibrating, understanding what their views are, understanding what their experiences are. The other thing that we've started to do last year, which was hugely successful for us, is an idea we stole, to be fair, from Australia, which was we started doing associate judges, which is people studying for their WSET diploma are allowed to come and judge at the IWSC. We don't include their results, but it gives them exposure to really experienced tasters and a fabulous variety of wines that they don't have to go and buy themselves.
Yeah.
And that's worked really well for us. In fact, two of those judges last year associate judges came on to become full judges for us.
Oh, nice. One of the things I get frustrates the heck out of me when the judging season comes around is it matches beautifully with the hay fever season. And so whenever I've decided whether I'm going to do any judging or not, I can't say, well, I can't put too much time into this because there's a risk. I'm just going to write off a day. I can't smell anything, can't taste anything, and it's going to be a waste of time. You know, and that bothers me quite a lot. Do you find that's a problem? Because the wine industry is so anti-hay fever people.
Yeah, it is. I think it's one of the issues. I mean, you know, there is so much that can affect a really good palate in terms of it may be the hay fever, it may be a cold.
Yeah.
I mean, we're very strict. When you're tasting down at the IWSC in our own tasting rooms, the girls aren't allowed to wear perfume. The guys aren't allowed to wear aftershave.
Yeah.
We do keep it as clean as we possibly can. So it's obviously an issue, and we do rely on the judges to self-calibrate to a certain extent. I mean, it's interesting. You talk about things that affect judges. We did some work last year where we looked at humidity, we looked at pressure, we looked at sunshine, just to see whether that affected people's judging. And actually it didn't. We found that people were really consistent generally.
Yep.
The biggest change we found was that, as you know, people in the wine industry have fairly strong views on wine, as we discussed a moment ago, where a couple of the judges had a robust discussion about a particular wine, and we found that emotional charge did affect judging later on in terms of the scores given. So that was really interesting from our perspective.
Yeah, I can imagine if you're not in a good mood,
yeah,
you're going to be harder.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Once the judging's finished
and
you've got the results out, how do people make use of your results?
We obviously, the standard way is, as all competitions do, is we do the bottle stickers. One thing that we did for the first time last year was we actually give artwork away. It's free. It's on a CD-ROM, so as part of our winners pack. Because one of the things that, especially with the big companies, that putting the stickers on is problematic. And actually what they want to do is use the artwork of the medals, etc., on their posters, on their point of sale and things like that.
Or even change the label.
Yeah. So one of the things that we do as part of a winner's pack is you get the artwork to that year's medals. And obviously from our perspective, given that we change the date on the medal every year, it has a kind of built-in obsolescence. But I think it's much more user-friendly for people.
Sure. A lot of the wine competitions have been tied, and you were tied to a magazine, Harper's, until things changed recently. Do you want to just give us an overview of what actually happened? Because you guys used to own Harper's, didn't you?
Well, the IWSC and Harper's were owned by the same company.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting in that, unlike some of the other competitions, our relationship with Harper's, even though it was an internal relationship, they were our media partner, and that's how we did it. Because the IWSC, unlike, say, the Challenge and Decanter, was set up as a separate company 40 years ago now, we've always been very proud and very, very careful with its independence. So Harper's was our media partner. When the business sold that product to William Reed, we changed media partner, and our new media partner is Drinks Business. So the actual change for us probably wasn't as much as it may have appeared from the outside.
Oh, okay. So you still have a media partner?
We do, yes.
And how important is that for a wine competition?
It's very important because it helps us put our message out to the trade. It helps us publicize in terms of the results. And it's a way of talking to the trade, and especially talk with the drinks business, given they're such an international publication. It's about talking to the trade on a global basis. So that's important to everybody, I think.
Do you have a media partner for the public consumers?
No, we don't. Well, certainly not at the moment, let me put it that way. It's something that we have looked at and probably will pursue in the future.
Okay. What's the future for the IWSC?
The future is great, I have to say. I mean, in the 3 years that I've been there, we've grown every single year, and it's been double-digit growth.
Terms of volume of wines tasted? In terms of
entries from our perspective. So, you know, we've had a really good time. The future for us is we've just completely relaunched our website, made it much more user-friendly. There's a great search engine on there now. So we start refining things like that. Next year, we're looking at doing some overseas tastings for the IWSC. This year, our president is Sir Ian Good from Edrington, the whisky manufacturers. And for the first time, we're actually doing a spirits dinner in Scotland in July. So we've got some really interesting new stuff coming along. So, you know, life does begin at 40 from our perspective.
Fair enough. Excellent. All right, Alan, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed that. That's the interview. Now we've covered all three main wine competitions. We did a decanter a few years ago, did International Wine Challenge last year, and now the International Wine and Spirit competition this year. Quite a nice wee set of wine competitions to be looking at. Before we finish up, though, let's have a look at this week's mystery wine region. As I said earlier, it's in Spain, and it is the rather unusual region of Gemilier. Clues again are that it's located in the southeastern corner of Spain near the coastal town of Alicante in the province of Murcia and Valencia. It's hot, high, dry, with vineyards planted in light sandy soils which lie over limestone. Production is aimed at red wines, the main grape being Monastrell, but some Tempranillo and Grenache, as well as some Cabernet Sauvignon grow there. Arion and Macabeo are the main white grapes, as well as Pedro Ximenes for making sweet wines. The whole area makes up the province of Murcia and Valencia and goes under the name Levant, so called because where the sun gets up in Mediterranean Spain. And it's the dry Levantian breezes off the Mediterranean that influences Gemilier's climate, making it semi-arid. However, early harvesting and modern winemaking methods enable Gemilier Dio to make some pretty good wines. I quite enjoy a Petit Verdot from down that way quite regularly, so there's some nice wines anyway. Right, we're almost finished with the show this week, so let's finish up this time with a quote from William Witchery, who wrote a play called A Country Wife, a satirical and anti-Puritan play written in 1675. So go you anti-Puritans! So here was the quote. Wine gives us liberty, love takes it away. Wine makes us princes, love makes us beggars. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.